From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The president's executive order is an important step to ensuring that we know who is coming into our country. It's a lawful, necessary, and order that we are proud to defend.
President Trump's latest attempt to bar some citizens of eight mostly Muslim countries from entering the U.S. suffers a second defeat as another federal judge rules Trump's own words help convince him the latest policy will be found unconstitutional. We'll get an update from the Center for Constitutional Rights. Then to America's staggering opioid epidemic and how Congress undermined efforts to restrict the flow of pain pills that led to tens of thousands of deaths. We'll look at the secretive family making billions from the opioid crisis. That's the Sackler family, owners of the company that invented OxyContin. We'll speak with Chris Glazek, the Esquire reporter who broke the story. Then to Guantanamo, where detainees on hunger strike have accused officials of a sudden change in practice that could result in them starving to death as doctors stop force feeding them and are no longer monitoring their medical condition. We'll go to London to speak with Clive Stafford Smith of Reprieve, which represents eight Guantanamo prisoners.
If someone's going to die from starvation, should you go against their will and force feed them or not? And, you know, when the British did that to the IRA, we let them die.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal judge in Maryland has blocked parts of President Trump's most recent travel ban, dealing a second blow to Trump's effort to block citizens from eight countries from entering the United States. In Wednesday's ruling, Maryland District Judge Theodore Chuang said President Trump's own words convinced the judge that the latest ban is a, quote, inextricable reanimation of the twice-enjoined Muslim ban. This ruling comes only one day after a federal judge in Hawaii blocked most of the latest version of the travel ban just hours before it was set to take effect. The two rulings temporarily halt the parts of the ban that would have blocked all citizens from Iran, Libya, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, and Chad from entering the United States. Both the Maryland and Hawaii orders do allow the part of the ban blocking some North Koreans and Venezuelan government officials to go into effect. This is Trump's third proposed travel ban and the first to include Chad, a small African nation that's been an ally to the United States. More details have now surfaced to show that it appears Chad was included in part because it had run out of special passport paper and therefore failed to submit a recent sample of its passports to the U.S. Homeland Security Department. We'll have more on the rulings blocking Trump's latest travel ban later in the broadcast. In Somalia, thousands of people poured into the streets of the capital, Mogadishu, Wednesday to protest the massive bombing Saturday that killed more than 300 people and wounded 400 more. The protest was a response to a call by Mogadishu's mayor to show unity in the face of the attack, which has been blamed on the militant group al-Shabaab. This is Mogadishu resident Fatima Noor.
I feel for every Somali family that's lost their loved one in the attack. That's why we came out here to protest against what happened on Saturday. We're ready to defend our people against attack. Once again, I call for Somali people to be united in our country.
On Wednesday, Pope Francis also prayed for the victims of the Mogadishu massacre, which was the worst in Somalia in a decade.
I'd like to express my grief for the massacre that took place a few days ago in Mogadishu, Somalia, which killed more than 300 people, including some children. This terrorist act deserves the most severe condemnation, also because it targets an already strained population. I pray for the dead and wounded, for their families, and for the entire population of Somalia. I beg for the conversion of those who commit violence and encourage those who work with enormous difficulties.
In Afghanistan, at least 43 Afghan soldiers have been killed in a Taliban attack on an army base in southern Kandahar province. A separate Taliban attack in the north of Afghanistan killed six police officers. This comes only one day after a wave of Taliban attacks against the Afghan military left at least 80 people dead on Tuesday. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said Wednesday he holds the Burmese military responsible for the brutal ongoing ethnic cleansing campaign against Rohingya minorities, which has killed thousands and driven 500,000 Rohingya into bordering Bangladesh.
Well, we're extraordinarily concerned by what's happening with the Rohingya in Burma. I've been in contact with Aung San Suu Kyi, the leader of the civilian side of the government. As you know, this is a power-sharing government that has emerged in Burma. We really hold the military leadership accountable for what's happening with the Rohingya area.
Human Rights Watch and other groups have called on the UN Security Council to impose an arms embargo against Burma over the ongoing violence. Israel remains one of the major weapons suppliers to the Burmese military. In Washington, D.C., controversy continues to grow over how President Trump treats the families of U.S. soldiers killed in combat. The Washington Post reports President Trump called the father of a soldier who died in Afghanistan and promised him $25,000 from Trump's personal account. But Chris Baldrige, the father of Army Sergeant Dylan Baldrige, says the White House instead sent him a condolence letter with no check included. After questions from reporters, the White House now says the check is in the mail. This comes as President Trump continues to face criticism for reportedly telling Maisha Johnson, the widow of U.S. Army Sergeant LaDavid Johnson, who was one of the four Green Berets who died in Niger, quote, "He knew what he signed up for, but when it happens, it hurts anyway," Trump reportedly told her. Attorney General Jeff Sessions testified to the House Judiciary Committee Wednesday as part of the ongoing investigation into whether the Trump campaign colluded with Russia to sway the 2016 presidential election. During his testimony, Sessions insisted he has the right to jail journalists. This is Sessions being questioned by Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar.
Will you commit to not putting reporters in jail for doing their jobs?
Well, I don't know that I can make a blanket commitment to that effect, but I would say this. We've not taken any aggressive action against the media at this point, but we have matters that involve the most serious national security issues that put our country at risk. And we will utilize the authorities that we have legally and constitutionally if we have to.
NBC is reporting a shakeup inside the Democratic National Committee has ousted some longtime officials over their opposition to DNC Chair Tom Perez. The shakeup is part of an ongoing struggle between the insurgent progressive wing of the DNC, fueled by Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, and the DNC's more centrist wing, which Perez represents. Among those ousted, James Zogby, head of the Arab American Institute, prominent Sanders supporter, and Barbara Caspar Cyperstein, the first transgender member of the DNC. In Florida, Governor Rick Scott has declared a state of emergency in Alachua County ahead of today's scheduled speech by white supremacist Richard Spencer at the University of Florida in Gainesville. Thousands of people are expected to attend protests aimed at preventing Spencer from speaking this afternoon. Richard Spencer was one of the headline speakers during the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, in August, where the white nationalists and neo-Nazis killed one anti-racist protester and injured dozens others. In Britain, government figures show hate crimes have surged to record high levels over the last year, with more than 80,000 hate crimes reported between March 2016 and March 2017. The researchers said the increase in hate crimes was fueled by the Brexit vote to leave the European Union, as well as the terrorist attacks in London and Manchester. About 80% of the attacks were racially motivated. In the West African nation of Togo, soldiers shot dead at least four protesters Wednesday during the latest round of mass protests demanding an end to the decades of rule by the Grasimbe family dynasty. Wednesday's protest was the latest in months of massive demonstrations demanding that the president's ouster and the reinstatement of constitutional term limits in Togo. In Mexico, the Zapatistas have nominated indigenous activist Maria de Jesus Patricio Martinez to run for president in the upcoming election, July 2018. Patricio Martinez is spokesperson for the National Indigenous Congress. She said the government's poor response to a massive earthquake 1 month ago helped convince her to run for the presidency.
It became clear that for those in power, those of us from below don't matter. So what do we have to do? We have to organize ourselves. This is our proposal. We have to organize ourselves and extend our hands to all and put an end to this capitalist system, this patriarchal system, this racist and classist system. We are experiencing this firsthand.
Back in the United States and California, nearly 150 women, including legislators and lobbyists, have come forward to denounce widespread and pervasive sexual harassment in California's capital. In a letter, the women write, quote, "As women leaders in politics in a state that postures itself as a leader in justice and equality, you might assume our experience has been different. It is not. Men have groped and touched us without our consent, made inappropriate comments about our bodies and our abilities. They've leveraged their power and positions to treat us however they would like," the women wrote. In New York City, two New York police officers are being investigated for rape after an 18-year-old girl said the two undercover officers handcuffed her during a traffic stop, put her in the back of an unmarked police van. Then, while she was still handcuffed, one of the cops raped her and both forced her to perform oral sex on them, she said. Testing shows the DNA of the two police officers, Richard Hall and Eddie Martins, was found on the teenager. The two police officers are claiming the act was consensual. An award-winning journalist, Rita Henley Jensen, has died at the age of 70. Jensen was a domestic violence survivor who in 2000 founded Women's E-News, then the only independent daily news service focusing on women. She also founded the Jane Crow Project, an investigative news outlet focused on how racial and gender bias affects women's health and reproductive rights. She died Wednesday morning after a long battle with cancer. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. President Trump's latest attempt to bar some citizens of eight countries from entering the U.S. has suffered a second federal court defeat. On Wednesday, U.S. District Judge Theodore Chuang of Maryland ruled Trump's own words helped convince the judge that the latest policy is, quote, an inextricable reanimation of the twice-enjoined Muslim ban and is likely to be found unconstitutional. This comes after a federal judge in Hawaii blocked most of the latest version of a travel ban on Tuesday, just hours before it was set to take effect. U.S. District Judge Derek Watson had previously blocked plans by the administration to ban refugees and travelers from six Muslim-majority nations. This week, he ruled the latest ban, quote, plainly discriminates based on nationality in violation of the law as well as, quote, the founding principles of this nation.
The revised ban removes Sudan from the original list and added the countries of Chad and North Korea and some government officials from Venezuela. The new order also includes restrictions on citizens from Iraq as well as all citizens of Iran, Libya, Syria, Yemen, and Somalia. Both the Maryland and Hawaii orders will allow a ban on some North Koreans and Venezuelans to go into effect. The Supreme Court was scheduled to hear arguments this month on an earlier version of a travel ban, but canceled the hearing after Trump issued new restrictions. The White House has vowed to appeal the latest ruling. For more, we're joined by Bahar Azmi, who is legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Bahar.
Mm-hmm.
Explain what just took place. Maryland court ruling after the Hawaii judge ruled.
Yes. So this is the third iteration of the Muslim ban, which attempts to clothe the previous versions that were just very facially, obviously directed at nationality with some legal pretense. The previous version simply banned all individuals from these eight countries. This version had a purportedly neutral rationale, that is, these are countries who share insufficient security information with the United States. But these two courts saw through that rationale and agreed that the threat of discrimination from the first to the second to the third is still intact.
Well, let's go to Attorney General Jeff Sessions speaking on Wednesday. He defended this third travel ban of the Trump administration.
The Department of Justice is resolutely focused on dealing with the terrorism threats that we face. They are real. The military tells us they can expect not a reduction after ISIS is defeated, but maybe even an increase in attacks. The president's executive order is an important step to ensuring that we know who is coming into our country. It's a lawful, necessary, and order that we are proud to defend. And indeed, most may not know, the Supreme Court has already vacated one court's injunction against that order, and we're confident we'll prevail as time goes by in the Supreme Court.
So that's Attorney General Jeff Sessions speaking Wednesday in defense of this ban.
Yeah, I mean, it's as if, imagine Orville Faubus, the segregationist governor of Alabama, bans all black applicants to the University of Arkansas, and then that gets struck down by the courts, and he next decides to ban all applicants from 10 high schools to the University of Arkansas. Nine of them happen to be all black high schools. No court would accept that as reasonable or non-discriminatory, and that's what we have in the case of this latest version of the Muslim ban.
So explain what happens now with these two federal courts, one in Hawaii, and I couldn't help think about Hawaii being one of the judges that struck down the ban because of what Jeff Sessions famously said on a right-wing radio show. How is it possible that a man on an island in the Pacific can stop the president of the United States?
Yeah, which speaks to the general insufficient regard that Jeff Sessions and the Trump administration have for democracy and constitution. Principles. So no doubt the government will attempt to appeal these injunctions, but the courts of appeals in governing both of these district courts have previously upheld the prior injunctions. So they probably won't have much success in the Court of Appeals and will ultimately seek review in the Supreme Court.
But the justification, of course, that the Department of Justice has given is that the countries now listed on the ban are listed because an extensive intelligence sharing evaluation that the U.S. Undertook in all of these different countries concluded that these countries don't have sufficient restrictions in place, and that's why the countries were selected. So, in fact, it has nothing to do with Muslims or anybody else.
Yeah, that's the justification, but I think it speaks to the lack of credibility that this administration has. I mean, had this been enacted by the Bush administration or the Clinton administration, given the traditional deference courts give to executive branch officials in the context of immigration, you'd expect courts would step back. But this is just utterly implausible as a national security justification, given the way it simply reanimates the prior obvious discriminatory actions the government took, and given the sort of lack of a sufficient national security rationale once you scratch below the surface. I mean, we already investigate these countries. It's not like there aren't national security protocols in place when someone applies for a student visa from Iran. So it's simply a reanimation and speaks to the lack of credibility that this administration has in the realm of constitutional law.
I wanted to turn to another issue, but it deals with refugees. A federal judge on Wednesday ordering the U.S. government to allow an undocumented immigrant teenager in custody in Texas to have an abortion. The judge said she was, quote, astounded that the Trump administration was trying to block the procedure. The ACLU, which filed the lawsuit on the teenager's behalf, said the 17-year-old girl, who's living unaccompanied in a refugee settlement shelter in Texas, had been granted permission from a judge to terminate her pregnancy, but officials with the Department of Health and Human Services and other agencies refused to transport her to a women's health clinic for an abortion. The Justice Department, which is defending the Health and Human Services Department, has not commented on whether it will appeal the ruling.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a remarkable action that the government took, and it reflects kind of three undemocratic strands or reactionary strands of the Trump administration. First, the de facto attempt to block a court order by not allowing this young woman to access what the court authorized her to access, by not letting her out of the jail. Second, a deep antipathy to migrants and undocumented migrants or refugees. And third, this sort of reactionary pro-life cast that they want to enforce. They do not want to, in their view, aid and abet one's constitutional rights. And this is Jeff Sessions at work in all three dimensions.
Well, before we conclude, Bahir, I wanted to ask you about what, because everybody has pointed to the fact that both the Hawaii and the Maryland ruling, the injunctions placed on Trump's third version of the travel ban, are, number one, partial bans, and that they're quite distinct from one another. So what are the differences between them, mm-hmm. and what do they still allow to go into effect? Is it just that it will apply to citizens of North Korea, officials from Venezuela and citizens of North Korea?
Yeah, I mean, I think in short, they're far more similar than they are different. Both allow the restrictions to remain in place in North Korea and Venezuela because those weren't meaningful restrictions anyway. The Maryland ruling is a bit narrower because it only protects those who, quote, have bona fide connections to the United States. So those who are applying for visas to the United States who may have existing connections to the United States, and the Hawaii one applies more broadly to anyone who seeks to enter the United States.
Well, we're going to leave it there, but of course, continue to follow this all. Bahir Azmi, legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, the opioid epidemic. And we look at a particular family that has profited handsomely from it. Stay with us.
'Cause we're bigger. 'Cause we're bigger. Are we bigger? Are we bigger? Repetition. Are we bigger? Repetition. Fancy music. Are we bigger? Are we bigger? Are we bigger? Repetition. Are we bigger? Repetition.
Repetition by the fall here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to look at America's staggering opioid epidemic, the secretive family making billions from the crisis, and how Congress undermined efforts to restrict the flow of pain pills that have led to tens of thousands of deaths. President Trump's Commission on Combating Drug Addiction and the Opioid Crisis has said, quote, America is enduring a death toll equal to September 11th every 3 weeks. But this week, his nominee for drug czar, Republican Congressmember Tom Marino, had to withdraw from consideration after a Washington Post 60 Minutes investigation found he led a drug industry-backed effort to pass a law that weakened the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration's ability to crack down on addictive opioids and keep them off the black market. The Ensuring Patient Access and Effective Drug Enforcement Act passed in 2016. It made it nearly impossible for the Drug Enforcement Administration to intervene in cases where large, suspicious shipments of opioids are delivered to pharmacies bound for the black market. The drug industry lobbied heavily to win passage of the bill, contributing $1.5 million to its 23 congressional co-sponsors. Marino alone accepted nearly $100,000 in campaign cash from the industry. This is John Ranazzi, who ran the DEA's Office of Diversion Control, which regulates and investigates the pharmaceutical industry, speaking to 60 Minutes about the measure.
If I was going to write a book about how to harm the United States with pharmaceuticals, the only thing I can think of that would immediately harm is to take the authority away from the investigative agency that is trying to enforce the Controlled Substances Act and the regulations implemented under the act. And that's what this bill did.
The bill, introduced in the House by Pennsylvania Congressman Tom Marino and Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee, was promoted as a way to ensure that patients had access to the pain medication they needed.
Congressman Marino has said he's proud of his work on the 2016 law, which passed without opposition in the House and Senate, was signed by President Obama. Meanwhile, calls are growing to look at the major pharmaceutical companies who fueled the opioid crisis. A new investigation by Esquire magazine reveals how the Sackler family, owners of the company that invented OxyContin, downplayed the risks of the drug's addiction and exploited doctors' confusion over the drug's strength. The piece in Esquire is headlined, "The Secret of Family Making Billions from the Opioid Crisis." It begins, "You're aware America is under siege, fighting an opioid crisis that has exploded into a public health emergency. You've heard of OxyContin, the pain medication to which countless patients have become addicted. But do you know that the company that makes Oxy and reaps the billions of dollars in profits it generates is owned by one family?" For more, we're joined by Christopher Glazek, the reporter behind the investigation. Christopher, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
So, the name Sackler is famous in the art world because it's hard to go into a museum where you don't see an atrium named, whether we're talking about the museum, the Metropolitan Museum, the Tate in London. I mean, all over. Why don't you explain how we know the name and how we don't know the name when it comes to OxyContin and how significant OxyContin is when it comes to the opioid epidemic?
Yeah, well, the Sackler family is very interesting because in some ways it's extremely public and then in other ways it's extremely private. So you'll see their name on university campuses. Almost every Ivy League school has an institute or a museum named for the Sacklers. As you mentioned, they're
like where in university?
Oh, like at Yale, at Tufts, at Columbia, at NYU, at Cornell, at King's College London, at Edinburgh, at Sussex. The list really goes on and on and on. And in the museum world, too, I mean, there's named rooms or wings for the Sacklers at the Guggenheim, at the Louvre, at the Tate, at the Met. So people know the Sackler name, but the Sacklers themselves are rarely interviewed. They basically never give interviews. They're rarely seen in public. And almost nobody in the world, in the art world or in the world of higher education, understands that the major source of their fortune is OxyContin. And one reason for that is that the Sacklers never put their name on their company and never put their name on their product. As you mentioned, I mean, the reason I wanted to do the piece, we have an opioid crisis in this country, and more than 200,000 people have died from prescription drugs since OxyContin was released in 1996. And we have an accountability crisis also. We tend to think of big social problems like drug epidemics as the product of these large impersonal forces that are hard to understand. And there's some truth to that. But that can also distract from the fact that a lot of social problems also have their origins in actions taken by individuals. So that was something I wanted to shine a light on.
Well, how did you learn, come to learn of the Sackler's involvement in this?
Well, it's very interesting. So, you know, I had read quite a bit about Purdue Pharma, which had manufactured OxyContin, and which in 2007 had to plead guilty to criminal charges for what was called criminally misbranding a prescription drug. And they had to pay a huge fine, and three of their top executives went down. So, and there had been a ton of writing about that, but almost no writing about the fact that the company was actually 100% owned by one family, and that family filled more than half of the board seats and actually supplied top executives for the company. You know, one thing that it kind of emerged is that when they signed on to this huge settlement, which got a ton of press in 2007, it seemed like the top leaders of the company took the fall because the CEO at the time had to plead guilty to a misdemeanor. But he wasn't the CEO during the period covered by the settlement or during the crucial period of OxyContin's promotion and marketing. During that period, the top executive was actually a member of the Sackler family who owned the company. And yet the Sackler name appeared nowhere in the guilty plea. It was like 100 pages. It appeared all over this other document that was attached, which was a non-prosecution agreement. And so basically the government said, we're not going to prosecute any of these 200 entities related to the Sackler family.
So, Christopher Glazek, tell us the story of the Sackler family, their rise, the rise of OxyContin. Go back decades.
Sure. So the Sacklers were basically three brothers from Brooklyn who were came from a Jewish immigrant family. And they got their start, really, I mean, the eldest brother, Arthur Sackler, in medical advertising. So he was a really important pioneer in the field of medical and specifically pharmaceutical advertising. He was one of the first people ever inducted into the Medical Advertising Hall of Fame, actually. So basically, when he came on the scene in the 40s, there really wasn't much pharmaceutical advertising. There were these door-to-door salesmen. They're called detail men, and they would basically try to push their drugs on doctors. What Arthur realized is that you could use print advertising to reach a much larger number of doctors more efficiently. And he was actually the first person to convince the Journal of American Medicine to insert a color brochure advertising a particular drug, which at that time was an antibiotic and actually got involved in this big scandal about overprescription of antibiotics, you know, another public health problem. His big, huge first influx of cash came with Valium, because he was the one who designed the marketing campaign for Roche, which was the manufacturer, and he made Valium the most widely prescribed drug in America.
What was his trick there?
So the trick, basically, was that, you know, Valium, there was another drug that had already been on the market that was the same as Valium. It was called Librium, I mean, almost indistinguishable. And so it was this big question, well, how are we going to market this one? Librium had been marketed pretty narrowly for a specific anxiety function. His idea was to take Valium, a new drug with a new name, and market it for every kind of problem. And so he kind of they played with this concept called psychic tension, which was purported to be the source of indigestion, of depression, of sleep problems, of restless leg syndrome. And so
it was the word before stress.
Yes, right. It was kind of like what we now think of maybe as stress. So he was in this way able to vastly expand the range of potential patients and indications, and that way made the first $100 million drug.
And what kind of use did Valium have versus Librium?
So it was used by people who were suffering kind of what are called somatic problems. So different kind of physical manifestations, which may or may not have their root in something related to anxiety. Librium was narrowly targeted at people who had like a specific kind of anxiety issue, which at that time was not quite the thing that it is today.
So Valium was prescribed much more than Librium or Librium.
Yeah, way more. And it became actually the most prescribed medication of all time, you know, at that time.
And so move on from there.
Right. So Arthur also became a huge art collector, kind of established the family's foothold in the art world. And throughout his entire life, he had actually passed on jobs and businesses to his younger brothers. So he was involved in the purchase of this really tiny pharmaceutical company in 1952, which was called Purdue Pharma, which was on its last legs. It had basically been a kind of patent medicine peddler. It had this drink called Gray's Glycerin Tonic, which was, you know, in the patent medicine era, was also marketed for all kinds of purposes. If you have a headache, if you have sex problem, whatever problem. So they bought this kind of shell, financially troubled shell. And for years and years, Purdue Pharma didn't really wasn't a major player in the pharmaceutical world. It had one really good product, which was Betadine, which it acquired in the 60s, which was a disinfectant. And they kind of had this great fortune of acquiring the rights to Betadine just as the Vietnam War was amping up. So the government had bought huge quantities of Betadine to treat wounded soldiers. But still, you know, a midget in the pharma scene. Then they got into the pain business, and that's when the real money started flowing in. And they developed, you know, so the kind of company lore is that there was a doctor in London, because some of the family members moved to London, and who was associated with the hospice movement. Mm-hmm. And they said, you have a time-release asthma pill that isn't really selling very much. What if you made a time-release morphine pill? And they said, you know, we have these hospice patients who have these IVs, and, you know, it's hard to give them enough pain medication to sleep through the night. And so he said, you know, a time-release morphine pill could really be transformational. So they made this, and it came out in the United States in 1984 as MS Contin, which is kind of the predecessor of OxyContin. And it was targeted exclusively at the cancer market. And really, it was an amazing drug. It helped cancer patients sleep through the night without needing to redose. And, you know, addiction didn't matter if you're a terminal cancer patient. There was a problem with MS Cotton. Its patent was going to expire in the 90s, and the company didn't have anything to replace it. That was really the company's, you know, golden goose. So basically, younger relatives of Arthur's at the company, other executives at the company were brainstorming, what can we do about MS Cotton having its patent expire? And they said, well, what if we created a new time-release pain pill, but we don't use morphine. We use another derivative of the poppy plant, oxycodone. And we create a time-release oxycodone pill. And instead of marketing it to cancer patients, we market it to 30 million back pain patients. We market it to people with menstrual problems. We market it to people with toothaches. So what if we take this powerful drug that we know works for this one purpose, but then kind of give it to everybody? And that was the billion-dollar idea, the $14 billion idea that, you know, gave the Sacklers what is likely the largest fortune in pharmaceutical history.
Well, I mean, one of the problems with the term, I mean, I realized myself when I was reading your piece that there's a lot of confusion between oxycodone, oxycodone, and OxyContin. So could you explain what that distinction is and whether the name itself was chosen so that precisely this confusion could be created?
Exactly. So, you know, I talked to employees at the company, you know, and there's some reference to this also in some internal company documents. You know, OxyContin and MS Cotton, one's morphine, one's oxycodone, they're basically the same. They're kind of like Librium and Valium. They're virtually indistinguishable. But morphine had a stigma, which is that people thought if you're on morphine, that means you're dying. And ordinary doctors, general practitioners, family practitioners, they weren't going to prescribe morphine. Like, that sounded like some really serious stuff. Oxycodone, though, had a very different brand because it was in Percocet and Percodan. And so thousands of doctors, you know, ordinary doctors, general practitioners would prescribe Percocet for injuries. And so they were familiar with it and they were comfortable with it. But Percocet has a very small dose of oxycodone in it. As you alluded to, there was another confusion. People thought that oxycodone sounded like codeine. Mm-hmm. And codeine is another weak opioid. Doesn't sound like morphine. Morphine sounds strong. So they were basically playing on this misconception that doctors had, and they acknowledged this when they had to plead guilty, that doctors thought that oxycodone was weak, even though it's actually more powerful than morphine.
So let's turn to a joint investigation between 60 Minutes and the Washington Post on the opioid crisis. This is Joe Ranatsisi, who ran the DEA's Office of Diversion Control, which regulates and investigates the pharmaceutical industry, speaking with CBS correspondent Bill Whitaker.
That's out of control. What they want to do is do what they want to do and not worry about what the law is. And if they don't follow the law in drug supply, people die. That's just it. People die. This is an industry that allowed millions and millions of drugs to go into bad pharmacies and doctors' offices that distributed them out to people who had no legitimate need for those drugs. Who are these distributors? The three largest distributors are Cardinal Health, McKesson,
and AmerisourceBergen. They control probably 85 or 90% of the drugs going downstream.
You know the implication of what you're saying, that these big companies knew that they were pumping drugs into American communities that were killing people.
That's not an implication. That's a fact. That's exactly what they did.
Whistleblower Joe Ranazzisi speaking with CBS correspondent Bill Whitaker. In another part of the interview, he talks about pain clinics.
Pain clinics overnight popping up off an entrance ramp or an exit ramp on an interstate. And all of a sudden, there's a pain clinic there.
Had you ever seen anything like that before?
Never. In fact, it was my opinion that this made the whole crack epidemic look like nothing. These weren't kids slinging crack on the corner. These were professionals who were doing it. They were just drug dealers in lab coats.
You know what a chilling picture that paints?
I do, because I watched them get arrested, and I was the one who approved the cases.
So that is Joe Ranazzisi, who ran the Drug Enforcement Administration, the DEA's Office of Diversion Control, which regulates and investigates the pharmaceutical industry, speaking with CBS correspondent Bill Whitaker. Of course, he became a whistleblower. Christopher Glazek, talk about the significance of what this man said.
Well, you know, the opioid epidemic has many different actors in different parts of the chain. And this investigation focused on the distributors, who are basically the people who carry the opioid pills from the manufacturer and give it to specific pharmacies. And there's been a lot of litigation focus on them, some thought that, you know, they knew, that they had reason to know that certain pharmacies maybe were involved in diversion. And they have this ongoing struggle with the DEA about what's appropriate to seize and under what circumstances. In my view, what you want to do when you look at the opioid crisis is look at where the real profits are. And it's actually not with the distributors. It's really with the manufacturers. And, you know, people kind of think they're following the money. And McKesson and Cardinal are these huge, giant companies. But you really want to follow the margin, because that's going to tell you who's controlling a market and who's kind of like a minor toll taker. And the fact is that the manufacturer, Purdue Pharma, which really created this market, created all this business for Cardinal, McKesson, et cetera, they had much more detailed information about where pills were going. They knew down to the prescription level. You know, what doctors were prescribing what. The distributors didn't know that. All distributors knew was about pharmacies. So they really are just one part of this giant chain. But Purdue had the aerial vision of the entire thing.
And where is Purdue based?
It's based in Stamford, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that you point out in the piece is that part of the money that the Sacklers made from Purdue and selling OxyContin, in a foundation they have called the Richard and Beth Sackler Foundation. Could you talk about where they chose to donate some of that, the money from that foundation?
For sure. You know, we live in a billionaire democracy, and billionaires exert tremendous control not only over business, but also over the arts and higher education and over politics. And, you know, different members of the Sackler family have very different political leanings. Richard Sackler, who was the top executive during the time that OxyContin was mainly promoted, has given money to a variety of anti-Muslim groups. He's actually given money to several groups designated hate groups by the Southern Poverty Law Center. He's also given money to this organization called True the Vote, which was the original source for Trump's claim that 3 million illegal immigrants voted in the election. You know, if you go to what appears to be his Facebook page or his YouTube page, he seems to have some affection for Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, a kind of Brexit type. So a lot of kind of it also seems to be a gold bug, very concerned about inflation and things like that. Other members of the Sackler family are not right-leaning. Some of them are quite left-leaning, actually. But Richard's foundation, you know, and the money that you know, came from OxyContin has gone to a number of causes that you know, raise some eyebrows.
So what is happening with OxyContin now? Talk about the number of deaths a day. Talk about the bill that passed last year and was signed off by the president, not by President Trump, but by President Obama, that now has led to Congressman Marino, who is the choice to be the drug czar, having to withdraw under Trump.
Right. So basically what that legislation did is it hampered the ability of the DEA to seize suspicious shipments. It's quite a complex issue. Whether it really is the most important aspect of the opioid crisis is something that one could debate. It does seem pretty galling, though, that Trump nominated Marino, who was so involved in this legislation, to be the drug czar. Like, you don't want the fox guarding the chicken coop. That did seem pretty outrageous, and it's a great thing that has been exposed and brought to light. You know, but the key point about the opioid crisis is that what triggers addiction, you know, people talk a lot about diversion, the black market, drug dealers. That's part of it. It's kind of a small part. Most people become addicted to OxyContin by just taking it as prescribed. Mm-hmm. So really, it's the number of prescriptions. Who is driving the prescriptions and the total volume of opioid that's circulating through the market?
Well, you cite a piece, an LA Times investigative piece, which concludes that the American market for OxyContin is actually diminishing.
Yes.
So could you explain why that is and then how this drug is now being marketed quite successfully abroad?
Yes, exactly. So, you know, OxyContin's run into a lot of regulatory problems in the United States and a lot of bad press. Kind of borrowing from the big tobacco playbook, it's like when you run into problems in your home market and you get all these lawsuits, maybe it's time now to go abroad. And that seems to be what the Sackler family is doing. They have all these international companies that are related to Purdue, which sell pain products abroad. And, the CDC in this country actually issued this warning last year, basically saying that we're not sure that opioids are good for long-term pain at all, that maybe opioid use is not an effective treatment for chronic pain because it changes your pain threshold, and over time it becomes less and less effective. So, I mean, this was like a really, you know, a kind of a death blow for the chronic pain market here. But now you have the company going abroad, kind of reprising all of its greatest hits from the 90s. They released a study in Colombia saying that we believe that more than 40% of the population suffers from chronic pain. Hmm.
In May, a dozen members of Congress sent a bipartisan letter to the World Health Organization that warned the Sackler-owned drug companies were preparing to flood foreign countries with legal narcotics. The letter mentions the Sacklers by name, notes they own Purdue Pharma, and reads, quote, "Purdue began the opioid crisis that has devastated American communities. Today, Mundi Pharma is using many of the same deceptive and reckless practices to sell OxyContin abroad." Mundi Pharma, owned by the Sacklers, and the LA Times reporting the company circulated a press release in Colombia that suggested 47% of the population suffered from chronic pain. Your final comment on all of this, Christopher Glazek, and where it goes now.
Well, the big question is complicity, and it's a really tricky question. You know, is Tufts University complicit in the opioid epidemic because they've taken huge amounts of money from the Sacklers? You know, is a third-generation Sackler heir who maybe is a documentary filmmaker or a restaurateur, do they have some burden or complicity to address here? And I think that's a complicated question, but the solution to complexity is not secrecy. And what we've seen again and again is that people who've taken Sackler money and the Sacklers themselves have concealed their connection to OxyContin, and that cannot be the solution to the problem.
We're going to leave it there. Christopher Glazek, journalist, editor, whose new expose was just published in Esquire. We will link to it. The secretive family making billions from the opioid crisis. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we go across the pond to London to talk about what's happening south of us in Guantanamo. Stay with us.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. One day. Deep in my heart, I do believe that we shall overcome one day. And we'll walk hand in hand. We'll walk hand in hand. Every faith and every man. one day.
That's Roger Waters performing here at Democracy Now! We Shall Overcome, accompanied by the high school student Alexander Rowatin on his cello. Waters led the Countdown to Close Guantanamo campaign on behalf of prisoners at the U.S. Naval Base in Cuba. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to Guantanamo, where hunger-striking prisoners say U.S. military officials have threatened to stop force-feeding them and are denying them basic medical care in a move the prisoners and their lawyers say threatens to kill them. In an op-ed for The Guardian, hunger-striking Guantanamo Bay prisoner Khalid Qasim writes, quote, "They have decided to leave us to waste away and die instead. Now, as each night comes, I wonder if I will wake up in the morning. When will my organs fail? When will my heart stop? I'm slowly slipping away and no one notices," end quote. Qasim has been in prison for 15 years without being charged with a crime and writes that a hunger strike was, quote, "the only peaceful way I thought I could protest." He is one of 41 men remaining in Guantanamo. 10 were charged or convicted before a commission, but the rest are being held in indefinite wartime detention without trial.
Human rights lawyers have long opposed force-feeding in Guantanamo, saying the brutal way it's implemented is akin to torture. But those same lawyers say they oppose the sudden suspension of feedings and basic medical care, since their clients' health is precariously declining and such care may mean the difference between life and death. The international legal charity Reprieve is now calling on supporters to join a solidarity hunger strike with the prisoners. Among those who've heeded the call are British Labour Party MP Tom Watson, Pink Floyd co-founder Roger Waters, comedian Sarah Pascoe, actor David Morrissey, director and actor Mark Rylance, and French-born actress Caroline Lagerfeld. For more, we go to London, where we're joined by human rights lawyer Clive Stafford Smith, founder and director of the international legal charity Reprieve, which represents 8 Guantanamo prisoners. Clive Stafford Smith, welcome to Democracy Now! Why don't you lay out what's happening? What people may remember during the Obama years is the force-feeding that prisoners called inhumane. They called it torture. Now explain what's happening.
I will, and good morning to everyone. Back under President Obama, we had force-feeding, which there's a large swathe of the medical community that says that that's unethical per se. But the way it was done and is done in Guantanamo Bay is gratuitously painful. General Brent Craddock said in The New York Times that they were making it inconvenient, his word, by making it more painful. Well, just recently, starting on September the 20th, we learned that President Trump's team down there have added a pernicious twist. So what they're doing now is they've stopped force-feeding the prisoners for now, and they've said to the prisoners that the prisoners can go forward and they can starve themselves until their organs fail, until they get serious mental illness, until they go blind. And at that point, they're going to start force-feeding them again to stop them from actually dying. So they wait until they're half-dead and then keep them half-alive and then keep them forever at the cost of $11.8 million per prisoner in Guantanamo Bay.
What's the justification for that? I mean, why do this to them now?
Well, the wheeze behind it, I'm afraid, is they're trying to coerce the prisoners out of their peaceful protest. And, you know, this is just wrong. Imran Khan, the well-known Pakistan politician who's a strong supporter of Ahmed Rabbani, one of my clients, has written in the Washington Post today that there's a long tradition that we as Americans have for peaceful protest. And the idea that the Trump administration would try to bully these guys who have been on hunger strike for 4 years asking for just one thing, you know, give me freedom or give me a fair trial, that they should use this sort of medical malpractice to bully people out of it is just disgusting.
So tell us the story of your clients, Ahmed Rabbani and Khalid Qasim, if you can quickly tell us, to give us a sense of who are these 41 men who remain languishing at this U.S. prison in Cuba.
So there are 41 people at a cost of $500 million that could be well spent on something else. Of those, 15 of them are potentially going to have some form of trial, fair or unfair, in Guantanamo Bay. and the rest are forever prisoners who ain't going anywhere. And some of them, instead of being high-value detainees, are by definition low-value or no-value detainees. Let me just tell you about Ahmed Rabbani. Ahmed, and this is all corroborated in the Senate CIA torture report, Ahmed was originally sold to the U.S. for a bounty by the ISI, who said he was a really bad dude called Hassan Gul. When they got him, Ahmed said, no, I'm not. I'm a taxi driver from Karachi. And indeed, in the Senate report, it says, this is what he says. We don't believe him. He then spent 545 days in the dark prisons of the CIA torture process, including being exposed to strapado, an old torture that was done by the Spanish Inquisition. And, you know, what did they get for that? Absolutely nothing, except they abused this poor guy beyond measure. He was then taken to Guantanamo Bay, where he patiently waited for his release back to his wife and son, who was only 19 months at the time he was detained. And then after losing patience in 2013, he decided, what can I do? He went on a hunger strike. He did that, and then he was force-fed, and he's been force-fed for 4 years, and I've seen him down there. He is now 92 pounds, if you can believe it. He's just a shadow of his former self, and there he is. And Khalid Mohammed, in some ways, is even worse. Khalid, you know, I've known him for some years. He is absolutely nobody. I hate to say that. It sounds, you know, like I'm disparaging him. I'm not. But he is absolutely nobody from Yemen, and yet he's still in Guantanamo also.
So you say that Ahmed Rabbani now weighs 92 pounds. So at what point will he start being force-fed again? Because the idea is, as you pointed out earlier, that they don't actually want these people to die.
Well, that's a good question, because if you look at the medical literature, when you get under 30% below your normal body weight, that's when you're in real danger of dying. And he's now 33% below his normal body weight, and there wasn't much of him to begin with. So he is in real danger. I spoke with him yesterday in a legal phone call, this privileged call I had with him, and he's not sounding good. And indeed, there's a whole syndrome, a medical syndrome of hunger strikers. When you lose thiamine, you begin to get psychotic. You begin to get to where you can't make voluntary and competent decisions. And what I'm afraid, I mean, none of these guys want to die. They just want justice. But what I'm afraid with Ahmed is he's getting beyond the point where he can make sensible decisions, and he just might end up doing something really stupid and ending up dying down there.
You're calling on supporters to join in a solidarity hunger strike. Are you doing this? Can you talk about what you're calling on supporters to do and what you're calling on the Trump administration to do right now?
Sure. Well, look, let me first say I don't want any of you to hurt yourself medically, and perhaps you shouldn't be quite as stupid as I am sometimes. I did 5 days of a solidarity hunger strike just because I think it's really important when I talk to my clients that I can say, you know, we will take on your protest for now. I just want you guys to eat a little bit to keep yourself alive while we sue to stop this nonsense. And we did sue this week, and I hope to goodness the judge is going to order the government to behave themselves properly. Now, in terms of what we want, I've got some notes from yesterday, and this is the message that Ahmed Rabbani has for President Trump. This is a quote. What is the benefit of keeping this place open? They're spending over $500 million a year on this place. They could have saved the money, sent us away, whatever, and not have this headache. Show mercy, President Trump, if there is any in your heart. Use the money to give to your soldiers, your people, not wasting it here. Help the poor people. Help the needy in the U.S. You've got fires in California. Hurricanes, use the money for that. Really, look, either just set them free or do what we've done in America for the last 200 years, which is give them a trial. And I would love to have that trial. I don't think the government would. And then we'd get them out.
Well, Clive Stafford-Smith, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Human rights lawyer, director of Reprieve, which represents 8 Guantanamo prisoners. That does it for our show. Juan Gonzalez will be speaking at Princeton today at noon. I'll be speaking on Saturday in California. We'll be broadcasting from Marin on Friday. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Special thanks to Renee Feldstein, Guzder, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura. Thanks so much for joining us.